Welcome to Fresh Take, a candid interview series featuring thought leaders and innovators from across the capital region. These one-on-one conversations highlight the incredible work happening in our communities and showcase both where we are and where we are going as a region.
Welcome, everyone. It's good to have you here. And a particular welcome to my guest, Doyle Mitchell, who's the president and CEO of Industrial Bank. Doyle, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, JB. It's a privilege to be here.
Great. I wanted to give everyone just a little bit of a biographical background about you, and then we'll dive in with some questions. For folks who don't know, Doyle is the president and CEO of Industrial Bank, which is the largest minority-owned commercial bank in the Washington metropolitan area, and is the fifth largest African-American-owned financial institution in the country. And we'll talk more about the history of the bank. But notably, Doyle is the third-generation president of the bank. He was refounded, in some ways in 1934 by his grandfather, Jesse H. Mitchell, a notable Howard Law grad from 1907, if I have the dates right. Remarkable length of time. At this point, Industrial has seven branches in Washington, D.C., Prince George's County, Maryland, providing a full range of quality banking and financial services, including residential, commercial, small business, and SBA loans. And the bank, of course, has been expanding beyond that as well in recent years as well. So we'll look forward to talking about that. Doyle is well known as a small business champion and acknowledged for that by the D.C. Chamber of Commerce, the Minority Business Leader Award from the Washington Business Journal, and a number of other well-deserved awards for civic service for the region. Doyle, thanks again for joining us and welcome.
Thank you for having me again.
Great. Well, let's start by talking about that remarkable history, if you wouldn't mind. Just tell us about how the bank was founded, and I know it's a long and remarkable history, but maybe talk a little bit about how you were able to survive and thrive for all those decades. Because boy, there are very few institutions of any kind that make it as long as Industrial Bank has.
Well, you know, JV, the founding of the bank absolutely amazes me because it got started, you know, during the Depression. My grandfather worked for another bank at the same location, and it could not reopen when Franklin Roosevelt declared the banking holiday. And, you know, down there in the Shaw, the Droy Park area of Washington, D.C., it was a thriving Black community. But they had no bank that would lend them money. You could deposit in other banks, you couldn't borrow. And somewhere along the way, he got interested in real estate. And I think he sold some real estate. And if he couldn't get financing for his clients, then, you know, he wouldn't sell too many homes. And so he started to put together a group of Black businessmen. And I like to use the term, he sold stock out of the trunk of his car. There was no Black superintendent or commissioner in D.C. at the time. So they had to actually get a charter through an act of Congress. So that was a pretty interesting history as to how the bank got started. My father was 21 at the time. He was going to Howard and working both full time. And that's how the bank got started. Started off doing, you know, loans to businesses, loans for homeowners. You know, back when the price of a home in D.C. was $5,000 and $6,000, slow and steady grew the bank.
Yeah, and the legacy, of course, is long. But I know there have been some points in time that must be particularly remarkable. Maybe we could talk a little bit about those. But tell us how you then. Did you always know you were going to end up at the bank?
I didn't. I, you know, my father was a quiet man in his personal life. Mm-hmm. And my mother was a music teacher. When she was younger, she was a very good pianist. My grandfather was an opera singer. And even though he was very fair skinned, you couldn't sing opera in this country. A Black man couldn't sing opera in this country. And so he went to Germany. The long story of that is I really have a music side on my family, and I loved architecture. And so my first year in college, I was an undeclared major. My father never said he wanted me to be president, mm-hmm. but I knew he did. I knew he did in his quiet way. And sometimes my mother would talk about it, but I was really undecided when I went to school. And after I took a couple of classes and saw how, you know, supply and demand equaled profit, and we could make a profit in banking and really help people, I thought it was the line of business for me to be in.
Yeah. And what year did you become president, Doyle?
1993. My father passed away. I had worked in almost every area of the bank at that time. And I was kind of in the last stop of being a commercial lender. Mm-hmm. And a couple of weeks after he passed away, the board named me president.
Yeah. Well, the history of the bank in Washington since then, of course, is remarkable. The history prior to that, the 25 years prior to that, was pretty remarkable as well, because it takes you all the way back to 1968, of course, which in itself was a remarkable year.
When I was coming up, there was 26 D.C.-based banks in Washington, and one by one, they started to fade away through acquisitions and mergers. But I remember when almost all of the banks that I was aware of in Washington were based in Washington, headquartered in Washington.
Yeah, that that industry generally has consolidated, but certainly, you know, in the district itself and for the district, it's been undergoing a pretty remarkable transformation, as has the district itself. Let me leap way out and just talk about the present day for a moment. And this is something that that we hadn't previewed with you, but just curious. It's remarkable how many young people today don't remember an era when we had inflation.
Right.
You know, but here we are. Leading a bank, how do you think about the impact of inflation? And, you know, how does inflation affect a bank? I think for a lot of folks, it's been so long since we've thought about it in the country, they may not know those things.
Well, I think there's probably two sides to it. You know, banks don't really like low interest rates, and certainly not for the extent of time that we've had very low interest rates. So we do better when rates are higher. But at the same time, the caveat to that is it makes it more expensive for our customers. You know, housing becomes more expensive, cars, sometimes credit cards, and you know, the price of goods. And so for our customers, inflation may not be a good thing, particularly if wages are not rising at the same rates. And of course, that if they're feeling pressure, then we may feel their pressure in terms of them not being able to pay loans on time.
Yeah, I hear you. Any prognostications about how long this inflationary bubble may last? Are you of the view that it'll be fairly temporary? Any thoughts on that?
Well, it's been for a long time. Rates have been low for a long time. I think we'll probably start to see them rise a little bit in 2022 and maybe some more in 2023. Now, don't bet the market on my advice, because most economists are wrong half the time. But I think it seems like there's some pressure in the markets that will cause a rise in rates.
Yeah, it seems like it's going to be more than just transitory at this point. It is remarkable since it's been a long time since people talked about things like a spread or that, you know, something other than a negative spread.
That's right.
On rates, in interest rates. I'd love to talk a little bit about the bank's role in the community, because you folks have for a long time been very active through programs like your financial literacy programs for first-time home buyers and others. How do you think about that role, and how has that role changed over time as, you know, as the bank in the area has developed?
Well, JB, I think we have done financial literacy before anyone even coined the term, because traditionally the markets that we have done business in You know, African Americans have health gaps, wealth gaps, income gaps, and many times we hold their hands through a variety of processes. So we just kind of did it as a part of our business, and we still do that. We probably formalized it more so 10 years, 15 years ago, to various degrees. And now I think we even have curriculum that I think we started using it in high school, and now we actually use it in DC jail.
That's great. You know,
pre-COVID. And we love to teach. As I said, my mother was a music teacher, and I think I've inherited that part of her. I like to teach. I like to impart knowledge, and our employees do too. I think they love to educate people on financial services and watch those lights come on. And, you know, if there's an opportunity to help them after that, of course, we'll provide that. And we like to offer solutions like home buying and teaching people about the process so that they can get on their way to building wealth.
Yeah. Well, it's critical service. And as you said, it's something that I think many, more and more institutions have been focusing on in recent years, but it's been part and parcel of your work for a long time. How do you define the size of the bank these days, Doyle? How should people think about how big the bank is right now?
I look at the whole industry. So we're pretty small when you compare it to the top five in the country. But we're probably about four or five times larger than when I took over. Fortunately, new capital has come to our sector from a lot of those same larger banks. And we certainly appreciate that. That's making a big difference. And I think Treasury and the CDFI Fund has come up with some really, really good programs that are significantly larger than normal that we are in the process of taking advantage of. So, we're about $630 million in assets. I think the average bank in the country may be $300 or $350 million in assets. Most of the 4,600 banks in the country are really very small.
Yeah.
You know, small, rural, small town, community banks. And, you know, the importance of being a community bank is we know our customers, we know the communities, and we live right here in our communities. So you're kind of held to an unsaid standard because I've been stopped in grocery stores and on the streets. You know, and, you know, mostly good conversations, every now and then a not so easy conversation. But being a part of the community and being involved in organizations like I am and others that work at the bank, you get ingrained in the community quite a bit.
Yeah. That's great and helpful. We talked about a couple of acronyms that some in the audience may not know. You mentioned community bank. I think some people just assume all banks are community banks, and of course that's not necessarily the case. Also mentioned CDFI and MDI. Could you talk a little bit about what those different terms mean?
Absolutely. MDI stands for Minority Depository Institution. There's about 140 in the country out of the 4,600 banks. 18 are African American owned. We're one of those 18. And we are also a CDFI. Bill Clinton signed the CDFI legislation in the 90s. And you are certified for that designation by the CDFI Fund, which is a part of the U.S. Treasury. It stands for Community Development Financial Institution. And CDFIs are obligated to reinvest at least 60% of their assets in low and moderate income census tracts. So we had been doing that quite a bit even before the legislation came along. But the good thing about the program is the CDFI fund within Treasury develops programs for institutions, banks, and some non-bank institutions that actually continue to do that work. So there's incentives. New market tax credits comes out of that program. The Bank Enterprise Award comes out of that program. There's a financial assistance and a technical assistance program and a few others that we all apply for to the extent that we want to pick and choose. And in a competitive process, you're hopefully awarded some of those programs. And it's helped us to do the work that we do in those communities.
That's great. You mentioned that the renewed interest or the continued interest on the part of both big financial institutions, traditional financial institutions, I guess, the federal government in the sector, in the CDFI, MDI, community bank sector. And I know Senator Warner has talked to our group about the $9 billion, I guess, that was funded at the end of last year at the federal level in support. And you mentioned you're in the process of pursuing some of those funds. Yeah. And I know some of the value of that is that it's kind of catalytic. Some of it at least can be catalytic capital, that it's leverageable capital. So yes. It looks a little more like equity than loans, more like grants, I guess. Could you talk us through, those seem like big numbers. Are they big numbers for the industry, the kind of money coming from the federal government, the kind of support you're seeing from
they are. There's been a couple of programs, but the Emergency Capital Investment Program, ESIP, we call it, was $9 billion. And it has the potential to significantly impact our institutions in a very positive way. And therefore, because there's a purpose for them awarding us this kind of capital so that we can lend to groups of people and in neighborhoods that have been largely shut out of the credit process in this country, so that hopefully we can close some gaps and expand the size of our institutions at the same time.
Yeah. And that seems like one of the primary mechanisms that the country has to address the wealth gaps that are out there. But institutions like yours really are the front line of providing the opportunity, in part because you can provide the assistance beyond just the financial capital, the kind of literacy programs, et cetera. And there are, of course, our region, Baltimore to Richmond, as you know, and thank you again for your support of the partnership's work and your involvement with it. But as you know, we've been looking at the question, since we've got this region from Baltimore to Richmond, of the CDFI and MDI industry generally in the region, and whether there are things that we can do collectively to try to strengthen that industry beyond just the federal funding that's coming in, et cetera. We talked a little bit about this, but if you could perhaps share some thoughts about what comes to mind. Where are the opportunities, whether through collaboration, through increased commitment or assistance from some of the companies that exist here that maybe haven't historically supported that industry? What are some of the things that we can be collectively doing to make sure this is the strongest, really the strongest CDFI MDI region in the country?
Well, I can certainly speak for, there's four CDFIs involved with the partnership. And from a banking standpoint, the way we make our money is lending money. And so, many large companies, borrow, sizable amounts of money. And if we can participate in that, then it's not necessarily our bread and butter, but it helps to put good assets on our books that help us to grow and become more profitable. And of course, the economy has been a little slow when it comes to lending recently. And so it's really important that we not just lend on our own in our traditional markets, but if we can find other opportunities and be involved in large, affordable housing development projects or market rate projects or, almost any type of loan facility that, a variety of businesses in the partnership and outside of the partnership, it would help us quite a bit. We can't add as much to that credit facility that, the large banks do, but our legal lending limit is growing because of the capital, and every bit helps.
Yeah. So good. Jump. Please continue. That's really great.
I was going to go kind of to a different subject, but if you have a question,
I was just going to say on that front. First of all, I really appreciate that insight. That's something we will look into because boy, it does seem like a kind of a straightforward way if I understand, help the sort of balance sheet optics for some of these organizations, for your organization and others, even if, you're not going to be the lead lender to some of those programs, et cetera, right?
And many of our large bank partners, because, we have four new bank investors, Bank of America, Citi, Wells Fargo, and JP Morgan Chase have all invested, not just in industrial, but in many of the African-American owned banks across the country. And we certainly appreciate it. It's been a good jumpstart for us. And ESIP is going to be almost a tsunami given our size.
Yeah.
But one of the other things that we industrial has in mind is not only do we want to lend on the residential side, but we have seen capital for African-American businesses be something that has been a far reach. And while all the municipalities around this region, have good intentions on doing business with municipalities, and now, the Greater Washington Partnership is talking, about doing the same kind of thing, what I have seen over decades is that many of the African-American businesses don't have capital. Just like we need capital to grow and prosper and ensure our sustainability, our customers need capital as well. And we are trying to come up with some creative ways of educating, incubating, and trying to find some outlets for capital for these businesses so we can turn $5 million businesses into 15 and 20 and $30 million businesses or $25 million businesses into $100 million business or a $500,000 business, if they want to, into a $5 million business. And not only will it help our communities because, wealth is health and health is wealth. It'll help employment, but also it will help municipalities reach their goals. And, I'm not saying all business has to come from, local or federal governments, but if we can grow those businesses and one of the things we want to help provide is at every stage of the business, you have to think differently as a leader. And our bank is still relatively small, but I think I've probably gone through three transitions since I took over. Mm-hmm. And we'll probably go through a couple of more, and then maybe there'll be a day when I can't take it any further and someone else will have to do it. But I have seen as a commercial lender, many businesses not be able to make that transition because they don't have necessarily the mentoring, the technical assistance, and then of course the capital on reasonable terms.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly the path toward prosperity has got to be to create the kind of jobs that those kind of organizations, scaling those organizations has got to be one of the most critical path methods to
Absolutely.
Create, right? It's not, it's a lot of great economic activity in a lot of other sectors, but at the end of the day, if we don't create and sustain those kind of career and family supporting jobs for exactly those kind of businesses, then we're not going to be certainly what the region of the country can be, and even more to the point, we're going to be more troubled than we need be, it seems to me.
And I think this region is primed and ready. You've got a lot of talented individuals. I see business owners that are really good at what they do. Now, they may not be CPAs or finance people or you know, those kinds of skills, but they know their product. They know their skill. They know that field. And, you know, with a little mentoring, a little education, bringing some of those things around them or even just showing them where the resources are, I think can help many minority businesses grow.
Yeah, that's a good segue to talking a little bit about the district right now, if we can, and particularly, you know, second year of the pandemic, right? We're all now learning the Greek alphabet at length, much more than we ever wanted to know. But there's a lot of genuine concern about what's going to happen to downtowns and the small businesses in downtowns. You know, more and more of the large companies that are involved with us are saying, okay, you know, I thought we might go back to normal or we might go back to a new normal, but I actually think now we're going to be, you know, hybrid forever, that, you know, we're going to have a lot of our people just not going into that that former headquarter building. How are you thinking about that phenomenon and that trend? And to your point, how should we all be thinking about the impact of all that on the small businesses that, you know, historically have depended on that?
You know, I have not really thought about it. Clearly, small businesses are going to be more vulnerable. The small businesses that are downtown, and because you just won't have that traffic, you know. Although in Washington, it seems as though even since we're not all the way back, it seems like traffic is still taking care of itself. I don't know who's coming into Washington every day, but it still seems like it's a lot of people. You know, some of the things, I mean, and you're absolutely right. We don't know what the final numbers are, but it's going to be a good 20, 25, 30, you know, 35, who knows, percent of people that probably just continue to work from home and don't go into the office. And that's going to affect all of downtown and particularly those small businesses that are downtown. I did hear some conversations, I believe the mayor in Washington was having about converting office space to residential. Washington, D.C. seems like it has not lost any steam on new residents moving into the city, maybe a little bit, but you know, it seems like we'll get past 800,000 residents. I can remember Tony Williams years ago saying we'll get to 1 million, and everybody thought that he was losing it, but he's not. It seems like he may not be that far off. And so hopefully those small, and that's going to take a lot of time that small businesses may not have. But, you know, that could be one solution if it happens, you know, quickly enough. I think most businesses have had to pivot anyway to figure out how are they going to create revenues and more online presence than ever before. And, you know, some businesses have been successful. You know, the smaller of the smallest, you know, are probably struggling with that. But it'll be very interesting because we all around the country, we know our typical downtowns. And I guess one good thing is it may not be as crowded, so maybe there's some opportunity for some green spaces and the like. But I think it's a good time for larger businesses to, as they see their way, you know, through, which is easier because there's more resources there. Hopefully, you know, some of the larger businesses can reach out and help some of the smaller businesses, because smaller businesses create all the jobs. You know, I think it's small businesses create 70 or 80% of the jobs in the country. And I think we would do good to try to protect that.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And I think there is a lot of conversation, a lot more awareness about that right now. And I think that's a good thing. And I would concur. You know, the mayor has talked about you know, converting B and C grade office space to residential potentially. And I do think the district has that opportunity, which a lot of cities do not. You know, because they're not that appealing as places for people to live if they didn't have to work there too. And you know, who knows, there may be a nirvana here where, as that continues to happen, more companies say, well, I may not have a huge headquarters edifice, but I sure want to have a pod in DC.
Still have a presence.
Mm-hmm. Still, absolutely. So we'll all be pushing for that. I'd like to talk a couple of other things. And as always, the time's going to run out more quickly than I would like. But if you just to back a little bit to the bank here, if you think about where you'd like to see the bank in 5 years, two questions. One, if you think about where you'd like to see the bank in 5 or 10 years, how do you describe that?
We were talking about that today. We would like to be a fully digital bank, much more efficient using, you know, digital means and, you know, fintech, you know, where appropriate, so that we can improve and continue to improve our customer experience, serve them more efficiently, but not lose touch of those that need some assistance. You know, there are some people that they don't want to come into the bank. They want to use the computer and the phone and that's it. And we have a lot of that now, but we also want to be there for people that, you know, either choose not to use digital means or struggle with it because they need a personal touch. You know, there's a lot of automated small business lenders that have evolved over the last 10, 15 years. The problem is, when things go wrong in your business, you can't get in touch with someone. And that's the value that we believe we can bring to the table for small developers, small investors, and smaller to mid-sized businesses. You know, when we make you a loan, we're there. We're there. And we don't want your loan to go bad, just like you don't. And so, we believe that we work well with people that are going through tough times. And so there are certain things that, you know, digital lending can't do. And you only appreciate it when you hit, you know, you hit a block in the road and you need somebody to talk to. And that's what we believe community bank is all about. Of course, we want to be larger. We purchased a bank in Newark at the end of 2019, and they had a branch in Harlem in another very historic area, 125th Street. So we're in two traditionally Black historic communities, and we're excited about that. And we'd like to expand in some other cities, you know, along probably the Mid-Atlantic area, you know, maybe the East Coast, because what we believe makes an impact. It makes a difference in the lives of people. And sometimes it's not always just a loan. It can come through in many, many different ways. And we would like to expand that. We'd like to expand right here in the Washington metropolitan area. You know, I mean, we don't have 20 branches in this area, and nor do I think we want to pursue 20, but there's still some areas that we think we can make some differences in Northern Virginia, Montgomery County, and you know, maybe in 3 or 5 years we'll get to some of those other locations. People think that branches are going to go away and physical footprints are going to go away, and in a macro sense they will, but I think I heard this statistic a couple of years ago that people still choose a bank by where it's located. I walked across the street from my house and opened up a bank account, or they're close to where I work. But don't get me wrong, we don't want to bog ourselves down with a lot of brick and mortar. But I think what we want to do is we want to be bigger, but we want to be better. We want to be better, and we want to increase the impact that we have on the communities where we do business.
Yeah, well, that's great. Now, you know, I appreciate that the answer started with that balance. You want to do both, and but I tell you, I think, you know, if that world that we talked about, where you've got cities becoming more residential again, or at least cities that can, like DC, I think a personal touch is going to matter more than ever. And you know, you've got a 90-year plus legacy of doing that. My personal view would be that that's going to pay some big dividends.
And in tough economic times, I mean, it's critical, you know, through this pandemic, you know, PPP loans and
that's right.
we had to blitz and show customers how to get online, you know, walk them through that process, how to download the app and you know, be creative and use more of our digital tools, but our call volume tripled. I feel so bad for our call center employees. They did a fantastic job, but I mean, they were overwhelmed. Our call volume tripled. We made a lot of concessions, as I know other businesses did. And you know, we heard some tough stories, and we helped people out of a lot of tough situations. So, you know, when the economy's going great, you know, I don't think people necessarily appreciate the high touch that a bank can offer. But when all of a sudden your business is closed, you know, that's when people really appreciate someone being there.
No, that's great. That's a great story. And again, it's easy to forget, you know, it's, there's always the new news of tomorrow. We forget just, you know, the last, how important programs like PPP were and how critical institutions like NERS were to getting that money into the hands of everyone who just critically needed it. Let me turn to just a last couple of questions, if I might. You mentioned three pivots, sort of sounds like one a decade since you became president of the bank. Could you talk a little bit more about what those were? How do you think about those?
Remind me. You mean in terms of my own growth?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it was how to lead, knowing when to add certain critical positions. You know, one of them, we had to go through this metamorphosis to hire a chief credit officer. All we used to have was a chief lending officer. Now you need a little more balance, a little structure. Building systems and banking around compliance. Oh.
The C word.
Yeah. I mean, and that is still evolving because there's no shortage of bank regulatory compliance, you know, then or now. I mean, literally, I can remember the days of doing loans because my father got a good reference. You're George Jones's son. Oh, okay, come on in. You know, he's good people, good family. You know, you know, those days are long gone. You know, I am hands on sometimes, but knowing when to let go. You know, and we have some great people that are more than capable. And in banking, you know, just every couple of hundred million, you know, things change. The expectations change from a regulatory standpoint, trying to keep economies of scale and not losing sight, knowing when to add staff and knowing when to use technology. And more recently, when to go after acquisition opportunities.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's always something to learn about yourself and about the business.
Yeah. You know, leading during the pandemic has been a challenge for everybody. There was no playbook. You know, none of us had something we could turn to and say, well, clearly what you ought to do is, what did you learn about yourself as a leader? What have you learned about yourself as a leader during the pandemic?
I think I always knew I cared about people, but we spent a lot of gut-wrenching time in meetings, sweating about what is the right approach for quarantine, how long, do we close this branch? When do we open the branch? How do we do the hours and things like that? You know, do we encourage vaccinations? Do we mandate it? Things like that. I mean, we really had people that in some cases were afraid to come to work because we're a bank. And even though we limited our service to drive-throughs for a while, but even being next to someone, for some people, it was scary. And then going home and wondering if they had been exposed to the virus where they have two small children. So making a lot of those decisions, because I mean, we are really caring people. We're opening a new office in January, and we sweat so many details. It not just in the interest of how safe it's going to be, but what kind of experience we want to create for the employees that work at the bank. So, I mean, I learned caring for people from, you know, my upbringing, my mother and father, but the willingness to make decisions that always aren't popular and may not necessarily be great for business. Just believing that in the long run, if you care about people and you do what you think is right, then, you know, things will come to you and good things will happen. And here we are talking about an ESIP program that could double our size. So I think trying to do right does come back to our benefit.
Well, Doyle, unfortunately, we're coming up on the end of the time here because there are 20, 30 other things that would be great to talk to you about. But I think clearly the bank, your legacy, your family's legacy has shown that the actions are exactly as you stated, which is if you do the right thing, everyone benefits. Certainly the district and the region have benefited and continue to benefit by your organization and your leadership. So,
thank you. I appreciate those comments. Words. I've enjoyed this. This has been a great conversation. I feel honored and privileged that we can get our story out there and many of the regional large businesses that may have heard us, but maybe weren't as familiar with us at one time can get a little glimpse into what we do.
Yeah, well, it's they're gonna miss the opportunity if they don't jump quick. Gosh darn it.
Well, I'm excited to be a part of the partnership. You know, to add what I can add to the conversation, whether it's, you know, a different perspective or a different level of consciousness, or some real, you know, on the ground stories and perspectives. So I'm glad to be a part of the partnership.
Well, much appreciated. All of the above and much more from our perspective you have and will contribute. So thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for the opportunity.
It's been great. For those that are listening, well, this will be available as a permanent recording. We will get that distributed and available publicly. And I wanted to wish you, everyone that's on the call, a great end of the year, a very happy holidays, and a very exciting 2022 in all the right ways.
Thank you. Thank you. And you as well. And my greetings to all those that attended this. And we look forward to a good 2022.
Thanks for tuning in to Fresh Take. This episode was produced by Jenna Klein, Justin Matheson-Turner, Christian Rodriguez, and Nina Sharma. If you like what you heard, share it with your network. For more information and to access all of our podcasts, events, and publications, visit greaterwashingtonpartnership.com.